session number 10802, reel 3.
Look on this part, he fired a salvo of torpedoes inside the destroyer screen, and he caught three of us in his one salvo. Although it was in three separate lanes, he caught the merchantman, the stern of the Cairo, and in the next lane, he caught the Sheffield amidships. She then careered around out of control. We then had to wait until the damage control people had asserted what damage we'd got, and they realized then that it was impossible to salvage her, although she was still afloat, and the bulkhead seemed to be holding. I then went forward up into the mess decks, and at that time nobody seemed to really know what was happening, because we hadn't got a tonneau system. When orders were given from the bridge, the bugler and the bosun's mate had to race round the upper deck and through the mess decks, repeating the orders on the bosun's pipe and the bugle. Because, as you know, each order has a different call. If you only hear the call, you can recognise the order that's coming. I came through the sick bay flat, and the doctor collared two or three of us. At that time, a destroyer had come alongside, and he said, "You've got to give a helping hand with the wounded." And I helped to carry several of the stretchers out onto the upper deck and pass them over to the destroyer. We'd had, during the repair work done before that trip in the dry dock, we'd had quite a lot of new equipment put aboard. We got the new radio direction for the fighters, and radio communication between ships, which was a new idea then. There was only two ships, I understand, that had them. We were one, and I can't remember the name of the other one. They realised that it meant towing her, but the bulkhead started giving away under pressure. And to tow her back 800 miles, it would be suicide to attempt to drag her through the straits to Malta. The convoy had carried on and left us. The order was given to abandon ship, and we went over the side onto the destroyer. I unfortunately missed and went in the drink and had to be pulled out again. The destroyer then left her, and a second destroyer closed in and fired a torpedo at her to put her under, because we couldn't allow the Germans to pick her up. She still refused to go down. He then raced alongside, and he dropped depth charges alongside of her to blow the bulkheads in, and she went down.
Which destroyer were you aboard?
I can't remember the name, no, I'm afraid. It's 47 years ago.
Where were you taken to by the destroyer?
Then, within taking the crew, he would take, 350 of us aboard. Our captain, I understand, went up to the bridge and asked to take over command and catch up with the convoy. And the destroyer skipper said, no, he was captain of the ship. And with him having 250 extra survivors aboard, it was packed like sardines. He said, I don't risk it. And he brought us back and he landed us in Gibraltar. We landed alongside the Rodney and was put on board the Rodney for passage back to England.
Now, jumping ahead in the war to March 1943, I think your next ship was HMS Tuscan. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about her?
I joined her in Newcastle, Walls End, Newcastle. Swan and Hunter's Dockyard, a brand new T-class destroyer. She was one of the most modern then. She seemed to have everything aboard. Better spacing for the crew. The new idea of so many of the crew being aft and so many of the officers being aft. And so many seamen forward and so many officers forward. On the older ships, of course, all his seamen was forward, your officers aft, so that if one end got it, you lost one of the two. That way, you'd still a working crew left. We joined her, and we sailed then for Tobermory. We then did a working up period in Tobermory. Evolutions, as it's called. We then came down and we took convoy down to the channel. We was depth charging quite a bit, which is very heavy work. When you fired your throwers, you've got to get the next depth charge on, which weighs about 100 weight. And we got an Aztec ping and chased him. I was on X turret then. And we saw the mine floating down the side while I was doing a sweep. And as we swung into it. And that blasted the stern.
Where was this?
Somewhere off the channel. Channel Isle, somewhere around in that area. Never did find out exactly where we were. And we damaged the propellers. And steering. We managed to make our way back to Pembroke Dock. In Pembroke Dock, we went into dry dock for repairs. And I was there about 3 months while she was under repairs. I then left her and I went back into Barracks again for redrafting.
You said it was hard work in the mine, the depth charging. You mean you had to manhandle the depth charges?
They had to be manhandled into the hoist stows. There was a derrick on each hoist, on each thrower. But it was sometimes quicker to two of you get all of it and bodily lift it in rather than mess about with the hoist.
How dangerous was it manhandling the depth charges?
Well, if you dropped 100 weight of steel on your foot, it would leave an impression.
So it's dangerous from the weight rather than from the
explosion? From the weight, no, it wouldn't explode because the pistol's set and they're set for depth. And of course the first thing when we got it was to go around and set the pistols at safe or remove the pistols from the depth charges in case any rolled over while you were stationing in the water and it would have blown you up.
Did the Tuscan have hedgehogs?
Yes.
Did you work on those?
No, I've never worked on those. And as far as I can remember, I don't think we ever fired them.
So all the Tuscan's work whilst you were aboard was in coastal waters?
Coastal waters, yes. I think. You see, when you load the throwers up, there were a new thrower then, depth charge thrower. The old ones, when they threw the T-piece as well as the depth charge.
What's the T-piece?
It rests on a T-piece, and it's slotted in. And you fire, and it throws the two. Well, of course, you lost the T-piece each time. Well, then they got an idea where they put an hydraulic arm on so that it shot the depth charge off, but retained, we call it the T-piece. And we could fire two, four, eight. Eight in a pattern. But your speed has to be above a certain... I can't remember what that speed would have to be, because when they explode, you've got to be well away, because they don't... even then, it gives you a shaking as well. And of course, the ideal pattern is so many set shallow and so many deep and sandwich in between, so you crush him. But whether he'd laid the mine or whether it was one that broke adrift that we hit, I don't know.
Do you know whether the Tuscan got any submarines whilst you were aboard her?
Not as far... We had no claim. We never got a claim for any.
Which did you prefer, being on the destroyer or the cruiser?
The destroyer.
For what reason?
More comfortable, better facilities, and that on the... I was on the aftermast deck. We seemed to have more room. There was cushions on the seats. You had like an oven arrangement in the centre of the mess deck, whereby if a man was on watch, he could put his dinner in and it would keep warm. We also on the walls had electric heaters. Well, they didn't last long, because the lads were getting a fork and a round of bread and toasting. And when a destroyer's flat out and weaving, the time's out of count. Out of count, had a bloke stumble forward and push the prongs in the electric wires and blew them. So they didn't last long. But there was certainly more comfort and more space. Because she built for so many guns, and she was built to take that amount of ship's company to man them. Whereas the older ones had added the guns, extras added, and the ships were no larger.
From there you went to HMS Galston in January '44.
Yes.
What was HMS Galston?
Well, she was an American frigate. She was on loan from America. And she'd one forecastle gun and two pom-poms. It was a quarter-deck gun.
What was the main difference between a frigate and a destroyer in the Second World War?
Much smaller. And also, they're broader in the beam and they stand the weather better. They don't seem to roll and pitch as much. Although they're not quite as manoeuvrable as a destroyer at full speed. It's like a racing car. You can turn it on sixpence, but they don't turn as fast. So it was more comfortable on them than it was on the destroyer at full tilt.
And presumably slower?
Slower, yes. Again, I wouldn't know the speed. I joined there in South Wales. Cardiff. No, not Cardiff, a little place alongside. Which is now where that big sports centre is in South Wales.
Barry?
Near Barry. No. Name's gone.
Never mind.
And we then went from there, taking a convoy down to Gibraltar. We went through Gibraltar and on into the Med, dropping ships off and picking ships off, but we didn't go ashore. We went past Malta, and we dropped some off and picked some up and finished up in Port Said in the canal.
By now, the Mediterranean must have been a very different place from 1942.
A lot different, a lot quieter. There wasn't so much aerial activity or submarine activity. We'd about got topside of it then. We then went up to Palestine, to Haifa, and we picked up a detachment of Gurkhas for transport up to the Dodecanese, which were still in German hands. We then left, we dropped them off.
Where did you drop them off?
We dropped them off at one of the islands.
Under enemy fire?
No, it wasn't under enemy fire. It was one apparently we must have taken over. We were just beginning to take the islands over then.
What impression did the Gurkhas make on the crew?
Oh, quite decent little fellas. They were mainly billeted on the quarterdeck because it was somewhat hot. They had their own English officers. They couldn't speak English, any of them. But we got on quite well with them.
How did they travel at sea?
Well, out there it was flat calm. So it was all right. I remember we fed them. They lived on boiled rice and condensed milk. That's all they seemed to live on. And we landed them on one of the islands. We left there and we went up into Turkish territorial waters.
With Turkish permission?
I don't know. At a place called Castelritzo. It's on the map on the coast. I've seen it on the map. It was like a landlocked harbour, but it wasn't a harbour. It was just a landlocked lagoon, if you like to call it. And we lay in there for about a week. And the MLs and MTBs of our own were coming into us and handing over, I assume, intelligence information, which we was relaying back to Cairo. The only thing was we had to be turned to and manned the guns all the time, because you didn't know whether it was a German coming through the gap or one of ours. After about a week, we left there. We brought some Greek refugees back with us, which we landed at Haifa. And from there we went down to the canal, Port Said. We had to have the ship fumigated in Port Said because it was overrun with rats and lice and such like. They clear the ship and seal it up, and they use cyanide acid. The only thing is, we put a place to guard on it, and a large flag with a skull and crossbones on, which is a death signal. And you can see the rats come from below and camp on the upper deck. When they opened it up, it was one of the engine room artificer staff. So I had to go all through the ship in the fan shafts, that's your air conditioning, taking off the metal grills and raking dead rats out.
Must have been thousands of
them. Oh, it was alive with them. Alive with rats. And cleaned the ship up in general.
How did it got so infested?
Heaven above knows. She'd done a major refit just before I picked her up in South Wales. Cwm Bran was the place I picked her up. Possibly in the dockyard when she was under repairs. Of course, you know, in harbour, rats will walk along the mooring wires and that and get aboard. but we was absolutely alive with them. While the ship was being fumigated, we had a week's leave at Lake Timsa on the Bitter Lakes, Sweetwater Canal.
Wasn't it usual for warships to be infested with cockroaches and other vermin?
Yes. You always had a certain amount aboard which you'd never get clear of, particularly the galley with cockroaches. In fact, every now and again, the galley staff, or if the lads would amuse themselves at night, we'd get a steam jet and go in the galley and go behind the galley ranges and that and steam them out. No doubt steam, that kills them. And that. By the way, while you're at sea in the night watches, I think every ship I was on, there's a duty cook detailed off. And he has a large vat in the galley. And we call it Kai, which is hot chocolate. And in the night, on the gun teams, Captain the gunner would say to one of them, "Get a fanny, go down to the galley and fill it." And you could fill it as many times as you like. But the duty cook was there to see that was kept hot all night. And then it's a mug full of that, or two mugfuls of that, was nearly a meal in itself, because it was the pure chocolate melted down. You had a week's leave to each watch on the Bitter Lakes, alongside Sweetwater Canal. It stunk to high heaven. We then went down to Ismailia. And from Ismailia, we picked up a floating dry dock on the tow by two tugs. And our job was to escort it down the Red Sea. Now, it would be only doing about 3 or 4 knots, so that all we could do was to just keep circling it all the time, day and night, for protection. It was a boring job, because it seemed as though you got up in the morning and at night time it's still the same piece of land there, towing this thing. Well, I was in my hammock, midnight, something like that, up in the forward mess. There was such a crash. And I swung out of my hammock, grabbed my life belt, and raced up onto the forecastle. I was the second man on the forecastle. The skipper was the one in front of me. And he said, "You're quick." I said, "Yes, sir, I've been in 2 more like this. What's it is?" He said, "It's not what's it is, it's what we've hit. And we did a Yankee Liberty boat. And we did him right amidships. And as we slithered down his side, our anchor had caught. And we took 20 or 30 feet out of his side. Because he was welded." Like Yankee Liberty, what's a welded, you see, and it tears. And we'd slid round his stern. And his signal came across, "Stand by me, I'm sinking." Well, at the most, we could have only been doing 5-6 knots when we hit him. And when we sorted out, we managed to, for him, he wasn't sinking actually, he managed to patch up and he made his way to Ismailia. We left the floating dock, where that went I don't know, but we left it and we came back with him to Ismailia. All we got was a bent bow. So I didn't realise at the time, I found out afterwards, that the Galveston was originally an icebreaker and she'd reinforced concrete bows. Now, I'd been going about 20 knots. I reckon we should have gone straight through him. A bit later on, of course, there was a court of inquiry. And the Court of Inquiry, I wasn't involved. But I found out from one of the lads afterwards that the skipper had got a severe reprimand, Lieutenant Commander. So I says to Stripey, I said, well, that's nothing, severe reprimand. He said, if he lives to be 100, he'll still be a Lieutenant Commander. That's his black mark, he'll never get no further. And apparently what had happened was that the officer of the watch hadn't got a watch-keeping certificate. So, of course, the skipper has to take the blame. But I then left her in Ismailia, and I was made up to lead Nand.
What is a liberty ship?
It was one of the American merchant ships, one of the ones they built in the war, and they were a prefabricated job. They were built in sections, put together. They were so cheaply produced, and of course they were all welding, no riveting, that they were said that if they did one trip across the Atlantic, they paid for themselves. It was a wartime measure, actually. In fact, I believe I read somewhere once where the record was of building one in 4 days in one of the American shipyards. So if she did 2 trips, it was in profit. I left her in Ismailia and went up to Alexandria. I took passage in the Usk, His Majesty's Usk frigate. USK, Usk. Of which my future brother-in-law was aboard. And I got off at Alexandria. And I was in barracks at Canopus, just outside Farouk's palace, for a spell. Then I was shipped to the Carlisle, HMS Carlisle. She was then laying alongside the Maidstone, the depot ship in Alexander Harbour. And her main job then was minor repairs and such like to destroys small ships coming in.
Maybe we can jump ahead again now to your last ship during the war, which I think was HMS Blenheim, which you say you joined on the 12th of February 1945.
I've made a mistake there. I should say that the Carlisle was attached to the Blenheim,